Well, thank you so much. Appreciate the opportunity to do a more straightforward Bible study with you this afternoon. And I suppose before I do that, I should introduce my crew here. This is our family, my wife and I. I don't think I mentioned these folks last night, did I?
Nope.
So can I just tell you a little bit about these folks? You have here, of course, Margareth and myself. We have our oldest son, Michael, and his wife, Juliana. They live in Canada. And they have three kids. They have a little girl named Naomi and two boys named Joshua and Caleb. And he runs his own company on Prince Edward Island, but they're both worship leaders and involved in a church plant there on Prince Edward Island. Our middle son, Peter, is a surgeon working in Uppsala, married to Helena. And they have our oldest grandchild, little Joseph, who's 5 years old, and his sister named Sophie, who's three, and they are the ones expecting a third baby in the next week or two, so we're excited to add to that plan. And then our youngest is Thomas, who is a mechanical engineer working in Västerås, Sweden. Peter lives in Uppsala, Sweden. His wife is Emily, and they have two little girls, Natalie and Isabel. So seven, going to be eight shortly. We are really grateful. The only problem we have is none of them live in the United States. So as I like to say to people, I'm not saving for retirement. I'm saving for plane tickets. So that's the wonderful family that God has blessed us with, and we are most grateful to Him for His mercy to us, and that all of these kids are involved in church work as well. They're all bivocational, and as you know, in missions, bivocational is a big category these days. Many of the places where the unreached are, you can't get into as a traditional missionary. So our son in Uppsala, he actually works with Somalis and seeks to do house church planting, even though he's a full-time doctor. And our youngest son is involved in a church that is a church plant. It's become a little bit more mature now, but they do a lot of work with Muslims there in Västerås, Sweden. So God is working through them, and we're very grateful that they have stayed faithful to the Lord in that area. Now, last night we talked about spiritual warfare, and I've got to find my, let's see which one, and see, this has gotten changed a little bit, so I kind of have to search here carefully to see where the folder is, and I have very poor vision, so I take a while to find, there we go, church materials, that's the one, and there you are, Raleigh Church Conference. Okay, so last night we asked the question, what's the nature of spiritual warfare in spreading the gospel to the nations? Did you need me to?
Probably it's easier to recall.
Oh, yeah. Great. Yeah, that means I can
walk around a little bit, doesn't it? Well, as you can see, I tend to want to move, so that's good. All right. So last night we talked about spiritual warfare in the areas of the world where the gospel is not known for the unreached peoples. Today what I want to do is ask a single question of you, and then try to answer that through a study in the scriptures that will be a little bit more in depth. This is going to be a straightforward Bible study. But the question I want to ask you is this: how well do you understand your people? Now, when I use the expression "your people," you probably would think, well, people in my church. You're a very interesting congregation. You have three different language groups, or I should say groups, but three different languages represented. You have Cantonese, you have Mandarin, and you have English. So, in one sense, you could say, how well do I understand the Mandarin-speaking members of our church? Or how well do I understand the Cantonese-speaking members of our church? Or the English-speaking members of our church? But I use the phrase, your people, in a much broader sense. Do you remember last night I said the church is the only organization on earth that exists primarily for people outside the church? So I want you to get out of the Christian context of understanding the people who are in your congregation. And I want to ask the question, who are the people that God is calling you to reach out to with the gospel message? Who are your people? And how well do you understand them? Now, when you ask me who are my people, I'll tell you very, very quickly, very easily. My people are Muslims. I love Muslims. Muslims have been the focus of my wife's life and my life in terms of outreach and sharing the gospel for more than 40 years. So Muslims are the people that we love. And part of the struggle that I face as a Christian is, how can I express the gospel to my Muslim friends in a way that they can understand the relevance of what I'm saying? That they can say, this is a message that I need. And you know, as I do that, I need to be relevant, but I also need something else. I need to be faithful to what the scriptures say. In other words, I need to be relevant and faithful at the same time. Now, it's possible to be relevant but not faithful. If you think about what I talked about last night in the idea of Christian or the prosperity gospel message, you know, you follow Jesus, you're going to be wealthy, you're going to be rich, God's going to give you a Cadillac. Now, that's a message that's very relevant to Americans, right? Americans love their money. Oh, I can make more money if I follow Jesus. I can be more successful. I can have a new Cadillac or a new Ford. Well, that's a great idea. Now, that might be relevant to your average American, but it's not very faithful to the scriptures, is it? Because Jesus said, no man can be my disciple except he give up all his own possessions. By the way, that's in the scriptures. Okay? It's a powerful truth. You know, money is not what we're about. We're about faithfulness to God. So, sometimes people can be relevant, but not faithful. It's also possible to be faithful and not relevant. Would you like an example?
আজকাল তোমাদের কাছে আমি এই সুসমাচার প্রচার করতে চাই তোমাদের কাছে, জানো তোমরা সবাই এই হযরত ঈসা মসীহের নাজাত যে তোমরা লাভ করতে পারবে, জানো তারা সমস্ত ভাবে তোমরা পাইবে সেটা, ঠিক না?
Now, if one of you responded to me in Mandarin, I would be in exactly the same position, wouldn't I? I preached something to you just now that I promise you is very faithful to the Word of God. It was exactly what the Word of God says. But you know what? To you it was irrelevant because it was in the wrong language. You don't understand what I'm saying, therefore it doesn't make sense to you. It's not relevant. So the challenge of the Christian is to understand his or her people well enough to be able to speak into their lives a gospel message that they themselves understand is relevant, and yet at the same time do it with complete faithfulness to what the scriptures tell us. We call that process of sharing the good news of Jesus relevantly and faithfully, we call this the process of contextualization. How many of you have ever heard that term before? Contextualization. Well, the key word, of course, is the word context. In other words, the gospel is shared in a context. A context where people have certain ideas, certain assumptions, certain ways of looking at life, a certain kind of culture, a certain kind of language. And as I share that gospel message, I've got to try to find a way to make them understand. I am called, as a Christian, to persuade. That word is also found in the New Testament. To persuade people. But at the same time, I need to make sure that I'm being faithful to the scriptures. And doing those two things, putting the gospel into context faithfully to the scriptures, that we call contextualization. And what I want to do today is walk you through the Apostle Paul as he contextualizes the gospel of Jesus Christ for Greeks in the city of Athens. And we're going to go pretty deep here, because what I'd like you to do is walk with me through Greek philosophy.
We're going to have a number of quotations, not just from the scriptures, but also from the Greek philosophers of this period. And we're going to come to an understanding that Paul, even though he was a Hebrew of the Hebrews, a Pharisee who lived within the Jewish traditions, that same Paul really understood Greek philosophy and thinking. He understood his people. And I'm going to conclude our discussion with kind of an open question and answer time where I'm going to ask you, how well do you understand your people? Could you do the same thing for your people that Paul did for these Greeks in Athens? Do you know? I often like to put it this way. I say to my students in some of the classes that I teach, don't speak a word of judgment until you have fully and accurately understood. You know, oftentimes Christians are very quick to come up with a judgment. Something's wrong, and they know how to point out what's wrong with something theologically or behaviorally or in some other way. But they're not as quick to understand. You know, for many years, I have shown a film from a Taoist temple after the death of a father in a family, where they are engaging in calling their dead father up from the dead so that they may consult him. And you've got everything in that film. You've got singing, you've got chanting, you've got a shaman who becomes possessed of a familiar spirit. You've got all kinds of spiritual stuff going on that for a Christian is not good, right? You don't do that kind of thing as a Christian. Now, these aren't Christians, of course. They're Taoists. But the thing that people often forget, and they'll point out what's wrong with this film. You know, you've got divination, you've got spiritism, you've got spirit possession, you've got, you know, necromancy, you've got everything that the Bible says, don't do that, don't do that, don't do that. And that's true. A lot of stuff that's bad in that film. But then I say to the students, what's the situation? And usually, oh, what is the situation here? A father has just died. This is part of the grieving process. This is part of the grieving process. Now, is it wrong to grieve over someone who has died? Well, no, of course not. Now, are they doing some things that are inappropriate? Well, yes. But don't just attack that without first understanding what is going on inside of this family. They are dealing with the death of the father of the family. So often we're quick to judge the activities and we forget, what's the context? What are they dealing with? What are they struggling with? Because when you can understand what they're struggling with, what the grieving process is, then maybe you can come with a message that's even more relevant to where they're at. And at the same time, faithful to the scriptures. Does that make sense? I'm trying to use from a sort of a Chinese background, because I think many of you have friends who are Taoists. So you've seen some of this stuff at some point in your life. How many of you have seen a Taoist funeral ceremony or something like that? Okay, a couple of you. So you understand there's more to it just than the idolatrous aspect. Well, let's talk about Paul and his situation. And we're going to try to discern what it means to contextualize thought in the Athens of the first century AD. And these are all pictures from Athens. These are places where the Apostle Paul actually walked. These were buildings where he actually walked. I'd like you all, could you all stand with me for a second? I know we sit a lot and it would be good for us to stand. I want us to go through this whole scriptural passage. So I'm going to read a fairly lengthy section and then we're going to go rapidly through the material here. So just listen while I read this for you. Now, while Paul was waiting for them at Athens, his spirit was provoked within him as he saw that the city was full of idols. So he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the devout persons and in the marketplace every day with those who happened to be there. Some of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers also conversed with him. And some said, "What does this babbler wish to say?" Others said, "He seems to be a preacher of foreign divinities," because he was preaching Jesus and the resurrection. And they took him and brought him to the Areopagus, saying, "May we know what this new teaching is that you are presenting? For you bring some strange things to our ears. We wish to know, therefore, what these things mean." Now all the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there would spend their time in nothing except telling or hearing something new. So Paul, standing in the midst of the Areopagus, said, "Men of Athens, I perceive that in every way you are very religious. For as I passed along and observed the objects of your worship, I found also an altar with this inscription, 'To the unknown God.' What therefore you worship as unknown, this I proclaim to you: the God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples made by man. Nor is he served by human hands, as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all mankind life and breath and everything. And he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling place, that they should seek God, and perhaps feel their way toward him and find him. Yet he is actually not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being. As even some of your own poets have said, 'For we are indeed his offspring.' Being then God's offspring, we ought not to think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image formed by the art and imagination of man. The times of ignorance God overlooked, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent, because he has fixed a day on which he will judge the world in righteousness by a man whom he has appointed. And of this he has given assurance to all by raising him from the dead." Amen. You may be seated. So, Paul gets taken to the Areopagus, and the scripture actually mentions two groups of philosophers that he dealt with. Can anybody remember from the passage what those two groups were? Two groups of Greek philosophers.
Stoics.
Stoics and?
Epicureans.
Right, Stoics and Epicureans. So let's ask the question, who were the Stoics? Who were the Epicureans? And how does Paul appeal to them? Well, first of all, the Epicureans were founded by a gentleman by the name of Epicurus. He was a 3rd century, late 4th, early 3rd century Greek philosopher. And the Stoics were founded by a gentleman by the name of Zeno, who was a relative contemporary of Epicurus. And these two Greek gentlemen founded these two schools of philosophy that were prevalent. These were the two main schools of philosophy that existed in the Athens of Paul's day. And so when they invited him to come to the Areopagus, Paul knew that he was going to be primarily discussing philosophical ideas with representatives of these two schools of Greek thought. Well, here's an interesting question. How well did he understand his people? How well did he understand where they were coming from, what they believed, what their needs were, what they themselves understood were philosophical problems within their system? Or systems, I should say. And I want you to notice as we go through this that Paul understood his people very well. And I think God would call us to understand our people just as well. Let's start with a little bit of background. Paul begins his address by talking about an altar to an unknown God. He says, "Athenians, I see that you're very religious people. You have this altar that I discovered to an unknown God." What we often don't realize when we read this is that Paul is alluding to a very well-known event in the history of Greece. This event is described in the writings of Diogenes Laertius in a book of the 2nd century BC entitled Lives of the Eminent Philosophers. Now, Laertius was himself an Epicurean. He was an Epicurean philosopher, and he described various Epicurean philosophers, one of them being a gentleman by the name of Epimenides, who is considered to be a 6th century early sort of proto-Epicurean in his philosophy and beliefs. And basically, Laertius tells the story of Epimenides' solution for a plague in Athens that took place in the 6th century. The story goes like this. A plague broke out in Athens, a sickness that spread throughout the city. People were dying. And at that time, they did the various kinds of things that animistic peoples would do to try to deal with they didn't know medicine, so they figured, oh, we're having a plague. We must have offended one of the gods. So they did sacrifices to Athena, the goddess of Athens. And they did sacrifices to other gods, like Zeus. And it did not stay the plague. And it was a desperate situation. And someone suggested that this philosopher from Cyprus, by the name of Epimenides, might be able to come up with a solution. So they brought Epimenides from Cyprus to Athens, and they asked him to discern, he was probably a shaman type, if you will, to discern what should we do to stay the plague. And Epimenides came up with a rather novel solution. He said, take a flock of sheep to the center of the city and release them. Allow them to run in whatever direction that they want, and wherever they go, follow them, watch them, and when they lay down for the night in different places around the city, then at that place they should be slaughtered as a sacrifice to the unknown god who is upset with them, and in such a way, through numerous sacrifices in different parts of the city, perhaps the plague can be stayed, and whatever unknown god is upset with us may be placated in this way. And so they did as Epimenides instructed. They slaughtered these animals. They made sacrifices to the unknown god, wherever he was, whoever he was. And as a result of that, they actually erected altars all around Athens that were still there 600 years later when Paul came through the city. An altar to an unknown god. And according to the story from the Greek philosopher Diogenes Laertius, this stopped the plague. Now, Paul, at this point, has a hook. You know that in music, you can have a hook in music that catches people's attention, a catchy tune. Well, Paul has here what I like to call a bridge that captures the significance of something. You believe in an unknown God, Paul says. I want to tell you who that unknown God is. Let me introduce you to the God that you do not know. He creates at that moment a bridge primarily to the Epicureans, because Laertius and Epimenides were all Epicurean philosophers. So at this point, the Epicureans in the crowd, their ears are perked up. Paul takes them then to a very interesting passage. We're going to see something here within this. He doesn't go to this specific passage, but I want you to read a particular Epicurean passage so that you can understand the problem that the Epicureans had. This particular passage is from another Epicurean poet by the name of Lucretius, and here is what Lucretius said about God as an Epicurean. He said, for the very nature of divinity must necessarily enjoy immortal life in the deepest peace, far removed and separated from our troubles, for without any pain, without danger, itself mighty by its own resources, needing us not at all, it is neither propitiated with services nor touched with wrath. Now notice something here. The Epicureans basically said the gods are completely unconcerned about our situation.
They are distant, unknowable, untouchable. They live in perfect peace someplace outside of our realm of reality. Do you remember the statement I made last night, made by a Muslim man who said, I cannot worship a God who does not understand human suffering? This is exactly the same problem that the Epicureans had. Their gods did not understand human suffering. And yet the Epicureans have this strange story of an unknown God who gets placated by a sacrifice. That would seem to be a God who is concerned about what human beings think and say and do. So Paul is using this odd story from the Epicurean philosophers to kind of challenge their idea about God. Maybe there is a God who is concerned about your circumstance, who isn't just distant and out there someplace and not involved with us. So there is this altar to an unknown God. Now, who were the Epicureans at the core? What was their philosophy? The Epicureans were atomistic materialists. That is to say, they said that the universe is one, and it is a universe of pure matter, which they called atoms. They didn't understand nuclear physics and atoms the way we do today, but they believed that the universe was a mass of atoms, and that the gods were actually part of that universe. Sort of a pantheism, but a pantheism that was atomistic. And in their thinking, the gods, such as they were in one part of the universe that were atoms, yet somehow atoms at peace, not experiencing suffering and difficulties. But most of the universe was part of this materialistic, atomistic process of continual change and suffering and decay and rejoining and decay, and not a universe that had any meaning. Not a universe that had any hope. And so as good Epicureans, you know, Epicureans are people who like to eat good food, you know. Let's eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. Well, that was a little bit of the Epicurean philosophy. It's a meaningless, endless flow of atoms, and the gods, such as they are completely distant from that. Now, what does Paul say in verse 24 of Acts 17? After using the story of the unknown God as a hook to get their attention and to say, maybe your idea about God isn't completely correct, because there was one God who seemed to be placated by a sacrifice. Now, let's go a little deeper with this. What does that mean? And he says, the God who made the world. Now, you probably didn't notice that as an important point, but essentially what Paul is saying here, philosophically speaking, is that there is a difference between the God who made the universe and the universe. Right? You know, if you talk to a Hindu who thinks of the universe as God, pantheism, well, Epicureans had a little bit of this kind of idea that the universe is all there is. Right? Our atheistic friends would say the same thing. The universe is all there is. Paul here provides a gentle corrective. He says, no, the God who made the universe. The universe is not one. Or that is to say, reality is not one, but reality is two. There is God, and then there is the universe, and there are two separate things. As a Christian, you're a twoist. You ever thought about that? You're not a oneist. You don't think that everything is just one. You think that there is God who is one, and then there is the universe which is separate. You're a twoist. Okay? These people were oneists. There's only one reality. An atomistic flow of atoms. Materialism is the only reality. And Paul says to them, no, there is a God who made the world. God is separate from that world. And that is actually a corrective. He is correcting them at that point. He's saying there is a different reality that you don't understand. And then he cites, of all people, Epimenides. Remember him? The philosopher of the altar to the unknown God? You see, Epimenides, even though he's Epicurean, he had some ideas that were a little
off base from an Epicurean point of view. He made the statement, "For in him we live and move and have our being." Epimenides had some ideas about a separate God who somehow we were part of in some way. Now, to be able to say this, clearly Paul understood not only the Epicureans as a group, he understood the different main philosophers within the group and some of the disagreements that they had amongst themselves. Because there were some Epicureans who said, maybe there's a God in him, in whom we live and move and have our being, who is somehow somewhat separate from this meaningless, ceaseless flow of materialistic atoms. You see, Epimenides had some kind of a hope. And Paul appeals to that and says, yes, Epimenides had it right. At that point, he's essentially doing what I like to call connective communication. You know, some of the things that you think some of your philosophers have said are actually right. Amazing. He knew how to appeal to issues that they would see within their own group. So you might say that Paul understood the Epicureans. Would you agree? He not only knew the basic tenets of their philosophy, but he understood their different teachers. He could quote them, and he understood how some of their teachers disagreed with the general trend of the group, and that some of those disagreements were very significant from a Christian point of view. Let me give you a similar example from the Jewish community of today. Did you know that the Chabad Lubavitchers believe that Rabbi Schneerson, the Rebbe, is going to come back from the dead and be Messiah? It's a Jewish group. Did you know this? You might not have heard this. What's significant about that? It's a Jewish group that says that their rabbi who has died is going to come back from the dead and be Messiah. Does that sound familiar? You see, Judaism for 2,000 years has said that Jesus cannot be the Messiah because he died. Messiah can't die. And then a Jewish group comes along and says, well, yes, he can. Yes, Messiah can die and rise from the dead. And you know, the rest of the Jewish world is enraged with the Lubavitchers. Do you know why? They're saying, you guys have just opened the door to Christianity that we've held shut for 2,000 years, and you just opened the door wide for the Christian message to our people. Do you know your people well enough to understand the open doors that are there for you, for your message? If you were a person reaching Jews with the gospel of Jesus Christ, you'd want to know about the Lubavitchers, wouldn't you? Paul knew all about the Epicureans. He understood the different viewpoints within their own school, and he understood where the opportunities lay for the preaching of the gospel. All right, let's talk about the Stoics a little bit. Here I'd like to quote from a very famous Stoic philosopher, Aratus, from his book Phenomena. This, by the way, he was an author deeply influenced by Zeno. And here's an interesting thing that he said. From Zeus let us begin. Him do we mortals never leave unnamed. Full of Zeus are all the streets and all the marketplaces of men. Full is the sea and the heavens thereof. Always we all have need of Zeus, for we are also his offspring. That's exactly what Paul was quoting, wasn't he? He was quoting Aratus. He tells what time the seasons are favorable, both for the planting of trees and for the casting of all manner of seeds. For we are also his offspring. Paul cites this very poet at this point. So who were the Stoics? The Stoics were cyclic pantheists. Now, when I say cyclic pantheist, think Hindu. What do Hindus believe? Name something Hindus believe. Reincarnation. Okay? What is reincarnation? I'm born, I die, and I'm reborn. And I die, and I'm reborn. And I die, and I reborn. And it goes round and round and round and round in meaningless circles for all eternity. That is cyclic pantheism. Okay? So the Stoics were very much like the Hindus of today. Pantheism means that they were oneists. The universe is all one thing, and that universe is God. But God is a bit schizophrenic, he's a little crazy, he's gone nuts, and everybody's just spinning around in circles, being born and dying and born and dying and born and dying, and it's all meaningless because it never goes anywhere. So, if you're a good Hindu, what's the one thing you really want to escape from? Reincarnation. The good Hindu wants to escape from that meaningless process of birth and rebirth. Right? It was the same for the Stoics. But there was no hope from their point of view. History just goes around in circles. So if you are a Christian seeking to bring a message of hope to Stoics, what would you say? How would you appeal? How would you try to reach them? Well, the first thing Paul does is he talks about God as a personal creator. You see, in cyclic pantheism, God is everything, which is almost the same as saying God is nothing. It's not very different, frankly, from the atomistic materialism of the Epicureans, because even though there is God in one sense that encompasses the whole universe, he's not personal. He's more like just a meaningless process, going round and round and round and round and round in meaningless circles that don't ever end. And so Paul speaks of, he takes that phrase about our connection to God, and he says God is personal. So Paul quotes Aratus from the Phenomena, and also another poet with a similar statement, Cleanthes, from the Hymn to Zeus, we are his offspring. And what he's trying to say here again is connective communication. Offspring means relationship. We are his offspring means that somehow there is relationship. You have a child, right? That's your offspring. You have a relationship with that child. Now, you say that God is just a cyclic process, but I'm telling you, you are his offspring, and therefore the relationship is personal. This is a God that you can know. This is a God that you can experience. This is a God that you can have a personal relationship with. By the way, do you notice how similar some of these problems are to the problems that Muslims have? Or to the problem that Hindus have? Do Hindus struggle over the issue of reincarnation? Absolutely. It's a meaningless process they want to escape from. Do Muslims have this problem of how do I know, how do I experience, how do I have a relationship with God? And Islam slams the door shut in their faces and says, no, you can't. You begin to see if you understand your Hindu well, or if you understand your Muslim well, you have a message of great relevance for them. So, what do we say here? Once again, we have to say Paul understood his audience. He understood Zeno and Cleanthes and Aratus. He understood these Greek philosophers. Now, here's the interesting thing, which some of you probably found a little disconcerting. It seems is preacher and brimstone, doesn't it? Because what does he say at the end, verse 31? For he has set a day when he will judge the world by the man he has appointed. Now, we often say, well, you don't necessarily want to preach judgment right at this point in your people, do you? What you don't realize is that Paul is not preaching judgment here, he's preaching hope. Because you see, what is their greatest fear? That everything goes round and round in meaningless circles. And Paul says, no, it's going to stop. God is going to judge the world and put a stop to that process. And that is not a word of judgment. That's actually a word of hope. Because we don't understand how the Stoics... We don't realize that this statement is a powerful statement of hope and good news Here he really captures the significance of the Bible message and says, I bring you hope. The world is not involved in an endless, meaningless process of repeating itself over and over again and never learning anything from history and reincarnation that leads to more death and more reincarnation and more death. No, there is a God who will put a stop to that process, and he has appointed a man to do that. And he has given proof of that fact by raising him from the dead. Not reincarnation, raising him from the dead to eternal life. This is a message of hope for Stoics. Did Paul know his Stoics? Yes, he knew them incredibly well. He knew exactly how they thought. How to bring a message that was relevant to their circumstance. Can you do that with your people? Do you understand them well enough to speak truth to them in a way that's relevant to them? Paul is speaking truth. This is all biblical, but at the same time, he's preaching it in a way that's connected to them and that is relevant to them. Paul is contextualizing the thought or the message of the gospel. By the way, he's also introducing some new thought forms. Anastasis, the Greek word for resurrection, was a very different word than reincarnation. He's literally introducing an entirely new idea that people would be raised from the dead to eternal life. That's completely new in the Greek philosophical concept. They don't have this idea at all. And sometimes when you're bringing the gospel message, you have to introduce new thought forms that are completely different from what anybody has ever heard before. So there is that element in preaching the gospel, in bringing people to introducing new forms. So let's take a look at some of the principles that we see here. First of all, we have connective communication. Paul shares ways that their philosophy, their ideas, are also similar to the Christian faith. He brings out those points. The idea of a personal God, where it's found. The idea of relating to that personal God, where that's found in the local culture. He brings those ideas to the fore and says, hey, there's something here that you need to learn more about. We have some commonalities here. Secondly, he uses correction. He points out that there is a God who is separate from the created world. That their monistic, their oneism is incorrect. That the world is actually a twoism of God and a separate creation. And because God is separate from creation, well, that's necessary to relationship, isn't it? A God who is his creation, you don't relate to, you don't have a relationship with. It's only if you are separate that you can know and experience. Right? How did the French put it? Vive la différence. For those of you who know a little French. One of the Indian philosophers who was a tourist put it this way. I like the taste of sugar. I have no desire to become sugar. You get that? I like the taste of sugar. I have no desire to become sugar. So correction, there is a God who is outside of creation, and that God is creating an end to the cycle of rebirth through the resurrection of Jesus Christ. He captures the significance of some of the things that they believe. You have an altar to an unknown God. Let me show you who that God is. He's not unknown. He has revealed himself. He introduces new thought forms. The idea not of rebirth and reincarnation, but resurrection and eternal life. And then finally, clearly Paul has strategized for persuasive. The most interesting contextualization in this whole story is what? Where was Paul at this point? Where is he when he's preaching this stuff? He's in Athens, but more specifically? What's the place? What's the name of it? Areopagus. Why was he at the Areopagus? Well, clearly they'd invited him to go there, but the Areopagus was an open forum for people to talk about faith. So Paul says, if this is a good place to talk about faith, then this is a good place to preach the gospel. So I'll go to the most open opportunity and I'll preach there. So he's doing his street preaching in the very location where people want to hear new spiritual truth. He knew how to contextualize not only his message, but his location. He went to where the opportunity was presented. So this guy knew his people well. He strategized, how can I effectively, persuasively communicate the gospel in a way that they see as relevant, but at the same time in a way that is faithful to the scriptures. So, connective communication without syncretistic distortion. One of the things I love about it, if you study this passage carefully, you will not find syncretism here. He doesn't syncretize anything of the gospel. He doesn't. He's not unfaithful to the biblical revelation of who God is. But he does have excellent connective communication. He does correction through constructive engagement. He's non-judgmental because these people need to make a choice. Paul isn't being judgmental of them, but he is putting them in a position where they have to make a choice. And you know, at the end of the passage, what happens? Damaris, a very leading Greek woman, and a number of others join Paul to learn more. In other words, he actually calls them to make a choice. And he's really not judgmental in what he says, but he is putting them in a position where they have to choose one way or the other. Whether they're going to respond to what he teaches, or whether they're just going to go on with their own philosophical speculations. So Paul knows what it means to provide correction. He does correct false notions that they have in their philosophy. He captures the significance of the good news for the gospel for this culture. And he ultimately fulfills the genuine longing which is already there. When a Muslim man says, I cannot worship a God who does not understand human suffering, we have a message that speaks directly to that point. We have a God who has suffered for us on the cross. An incredible message of a God who understands us. And if Christ is incarnational and understands us so well, then shouldn't we also be people who are able to understand others and speak relevantly into the needs of their lives? So my question comes to you again. How well do you understand your people? Would you be able to speak into a non-Christian's life with this level of compassion, with this level of understanding, with this level of correction, with this level of capturing the significance of what they're longing for? And human beings made in the image of God do long for God. They do. Do you know how to appeal to that longing in the heart and in the life of a person that you know, your people? Finally, introduce new thought forms, an inevitable part of communicating the gospel. Vicarious atonement is always the key. Redemptive analogies. What does it mean to express the sacrament? By the way, the first story Paul tells, Altar to the Unknown God, is really dealing with this issue of sacrifice and what it means to placate an angry God. Well, yes, our God is angry with sin. And what has he done to placate that wrath? He suffered and died for it himself. And I don't, obviously Paul doesn't get into that part in the message here, but I'm sure that when Damaris and the others joined him for teaching, he then began to explain the message of the cross to help them to understand how God has redeemed them. And then strategizing for, I'm going to kind of hop over this stuff because our time is done. We've only got 5 minutes before we need to break. Are there any questions about this? If I were to ask you about some of your non-Christian friends, and I would ask you the question, how well do you understand them? What would you say? Do you understand your non-Christian friends as well as Paul understood the Epicureans and the Stoics? If you don't, then my next question would be, how will you learn to understand them better? Maybe some of your evangelism, instead of being just preaching right off the top of your head, it might begin with you asking them some good questions. If you would like to receive, I have a short book that I've produced. It's in electronic format. It's called The Seven Essential Questions of Life. And it is an evangelistic way of sharing the gospel that's based on asking good questions. And if you'd like a copy of that, I have my cards with me. I'll give you a copy. You can send me an email and I'll send you a copy of that book. And it walks you through a very simple process of talking to five of your non-Christian friends and starting out by asking them lots of good questions and figuring your people out. If you don't understand your people, then let's start a process right now where you learn about them and you discover who they are and what they're struggling with. And yeah, go ahead.
Say something, please.
Oh, some of the questions. Well, I have seven key questions I like to ask people. The questions are, where do you think we came from? Origins. Secondly, how do we get power or success in life? What do you think about power? Where does that come from? Thirdly, destiny. What's your purpose? Where are you going? Fourthly, how do you know true from untrue? Fifthly, how do you know right from wrong? Sixthly, what's the nature of humankind's problem? Seventhly, final question, what's the nature of the solution? How do we solve humankind's problem? Now, I use this kind of non-method method, because you don't know what the answers are going to be to the questions, do you? But I have found that when I ask non-question Christians these seven questions, oftentimes I'll get to what they and very often when they're done, they'll ask me a question. They'll say, well, how do you answer these seven questions? And that becomes a wonderful. We did this with a Chinese lady on the airport in Guangdong, China. And I went through my seven questions. And when we got done, she said, wow, these are really interesting questions. I've never really thought about this. Well, how do you answer them? And so Margareta and I walked through those seven questions and answering them as a Christian. And in the process, we shared the gospel message with her. And she received Christ that day. And we have continued to receive reports from her as she started a Bible study in her home. And we sent her an electronic version of a Chinese Bible for her to use in her Bible study in her home.
In China.
In China, yeah. And so we really think that we're onto something, that a lot of Christians don't really know their non-Christian friends very well. So if we can help you to figure out your friends so that you understand where they're coming from, you may find that witnessing becomes not only easy, but almost unavoidable. I find every time I sit in an airplane, I just have to start my seven questions, and before the flight is over, we've had a chance to share the gospel. And I've had many a non-Christian say to me, this is the most significant spiritual conversation I've ever had. I rarely get a negative response. Rarely. And I'd love to get you started on doing that. If you don't understand your non-Christian friends, let me help you to understand them. Does that sound like an idea?
Yes.
Okay. For those who escape, I'm going to put my email address up on here so that you can use that directly if you want. An email to that address, and I will be happy to send you a copy of my book for free. You can just, you know, I'll send it off to you. And then I'm happy to mentor you if you want to know more about how to use seven good questions to figure out your non-Christian friends. Yes, Don.
Maybe you can read it out. Some people can ask.
Okay. It says D Cashin. That's D-C-A-S-H-I-N. You know, you can cash in with Cashin, right? D Cashin at CIU.edu. If you'd like to send me an email, I'll send you the book and we'll talk further about that. Any questions? It's now exactly 5:15 and I think we need to stop at this moment, but we maybe have 30 seconds for a question if anyone has one. Yes, sir.
What if the person after you ask that question never asked about your, what do you think?
How do you?
About 40 or 50% of the time, they don't ask back. In the case of this gal from China, she didn't ask back, actually. I said she did. She actually didn't. What I said to her was, would you mind if I explain to you how I answer these questions? And she was very happy to hear that. Many times, people will ask. Sometimes they won't. Sometimes you get the impression that a person is not interested. And then I don't push on any further. I don't feel any obligation to tell somebody a message that they're not interested in hearing. But that's very uncommon. Maybe 1 out of 10 times that I do this, I'll get a negative response. 9 out of 10 times I get a positive response. And I'd really love to get Christians involved in doing stuff like this, because then witnessing becomes fun. I really enjoy witnessing. It's not a problem. You know, for a lot of Christians, they're like, oh, I need to go out and share the gospel. My way of doing the gospel or sharing it, it really is fun. And I'd encourage you with that. Yes?
I think the challenge is not if the person that you talk to is very friendly and willing to listen. That can be fun. But you will find somebody that usually very challenging and will challenge your faith. That is where actually it's going to go back and forth.
Yeah.
It's one of the scariest things about witnessing.
Well, I think the fun thing is when you listen well, when you ask good questions and you really listen, because you are trying to figure that person out. You're trying to figure out, okay, I need to understand them well enough so that I can share the gospel relevantly. It means I'm really listening. If you really listen, you are unusual. In this society of... people don't listen to each other anymore. I mean, they're all living in their own little worlds. They're all inside their heads. You go to a restaurant, and you got 4 people sitting at the table, and they're not talking to each other. They're all doing this. And you just realize we've lost the art of conversation. We've lost the art of listening. And if you as a Christian genuinely listen, not just to witness, but so that you can understand that other person, you are rare. There aren't many people that do this anymore. And it makes it fun.
So it's not your job to argue, right?
To listen and understand. And I often, when they'll say something, I'll throw it back and say, now, do you mean this when you say that? And so it allows us to have a dialogue. And then very often, when they ask me what I believe, they listen respectfully because I have listened respectfully to them. And, you get a wonderful responsiveness when you've done that.
So try not to debate or engage in witnessing.
You can get into this. I mean, I had one lady one time who said, when I got through sharing my gospel message, she said, well, what do you think about homosexuals? Then I got a little bit dicey because she just told me that she was going to London to spend time with her boyfriend. Which meant, of course, they're going to sleep together. They're going to be in the same hotel. So my response is, well, why do you ask me about homosexuality? Why don't you just ask me about fornication? That's really to put your finger on a hot point, right? Because in our society today, they have litmus tests of whether you're house trained or not. And if you don't have a positive thing to say about homosexuals, then you're a bad person. Well, Bible has a lot of negative stuff to say about all kinds of stuff. You pick your topic, and I'll find one that you've been violating, and we'll talk about that if you want. But you get this by training. You got to do this enough so you learn how to get people to think about, rather than something theoretical, what you're going to get upset about, let me talk about something that's relevant to you and where you're at. And that's what I want to get back to. I want to get back to what's relevant to her. Because, I'm honestly convinced that when she's sleeping with a boyfriend, she really wishes she could marry him. She knows she's being used. She's not stupid. And wouldn't it be wonderful to give her a message where she realizes, yeah, I'm right to feel that it's wrong that I get used like this by a guy who's not willing to commit, not willing to give his life to me. So I have good news for her, even though I'm going to ask her, what do you think about fornication?
There's a message of hope in that. Okay, I'm over by about 5 minutes, so, and we need to have our meal tonight. So thank you all, and we'll see you over dinner.
Question, do you have friends of Muslim friends? If you have, tonight, Dr. Kasha has a wonderful topic for us. How many toys? Muslims are